Good evening, everyone. That's what's said. My name is Jeff, and I am a recovered alcoholic. It is by the grace of a very loving God, the hand of his love, and an act of divine intervention that I'm alive at all today and standing here before you. And I was given that by the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the group for the invitation to speak. Sam, thank you very much for your hospitality. I appreciate it. Normally, it is a privilege to speak or to do anything that's constructive, that's beneficial to AA. And I'm somewhat intimidated tonight because this is a speaker meeting, so you guys are used to real AA speakers, and this is the holiday week. You've got me instead. I was talking to my sponsor on the way up here. My ride up here was supervised, you know, so that I wouldn't be totally insane when I got here. I'm 10 generations removed from Virginia, and whenever I get the privilege to come up to this part of the country and see the territory, there's something inside of me that just goes, ah. And in my estimation or in my mind, if there ever is a place that's called God's country, it's this place up here. So I'm glad to be up here. I got the worst of both worlds, though. Normally, you know, you can go speak out of town somewhere, and they don't know who you are. I can tell whatever story I want to. But I'm not quite far enough out of town to do that. And like I said, I was supervised by my sponsor, so I can't make up something. But it's just long enough to spend a couple hours or so driving up here to spend a lot of time thinking about me. My sobriety date is October 14th, 2010. And like I've already said, I don't take credit for that date. That was the date that God acted in my life. I don't know if anybody else in here is, let's say, under 5 years of sobriety, but, you know, in the interest of disclosure, doing the math, that's 4 years sober, so my life is largely still being reconstructed. I want to talk about what went on October 13th, 2010. The couple of months that led up to that date, I had been reduced by my drinking to... my tolerance was down to almost nil. I was largely what I would call bum drinking. I could take a 40-ounce of beer and one of these malt liquor mixed energy drinks in combination if I could scrape up the change. I was no longer able to hold the bottle up to my mouth by myself. It took two hands and sometimes steadying it because that was sober. The first pull was not usually successful anymore. I was unable to keep it down. The second one usually brought up whatever I was trying to swallow plus some blood. And it usually took like the third swig or whatever, the third pull in order to get any of that to actually stay down. And once that first one stayed down, I could continue with the rest of the bottle. I hated it. I was drinking against my own will, and I had been drinking against my own will for a long time. I would get that false sense of I think I can breathe now and at least just exist. And then I would go on and finish the ingredients that I just described to you and would stay drunk for about a day and a half, for about 18 hours, and then spend the next day and a half literally sick. Body parts hurting. I don't want to be graphic, but it wasn't pretty. And I'd turn around and do that all over again. And every single time I went across the street to scrape up the change, crawl out of the house that I was terrified of leaving, I hated myself for doing it. I could mostly get out the door by, you know, 6 o'clock. They would start selling booze at the little corner market across the street. So I would be out the door at 6 because hopefully the sun wasn't up yet. So neighbors wouldn't see me going out the door. I didn't want them to see me. Alcohol took everything away from me, ultimately. That's the last couple of months that I was drinking. I was having a little problem understanding what day of the week it was. So I got this big calendar, and I put it on the wall, a big kind of oversized calendar, and put it on the wall, and I had a big blue Sharpie, and I was trying to put X's next to each day. And I said, Jeff, if you can just put an X on the calendar, maybe you'll know what day it is. That idea had come up with... about five months left to go in my drinking, and what happened was I got to where I was disciplined enough to put an X in each day, but I was in the wrong week. And then later on, I was in the wrong month. At the same time, the idea of leaving that house, I'm a person who I had become isolated, but I am not an isolator. I like being around people. I think sometimes we can get that confused in here. I've talked to people, many people like myself, who said, oh yeah, I'm an isolator, I do that. And my question to them is always, were you doing it on purpose, or is that just how you ended up anyway? Because there's a difference. I liked being around people, and the reason this was important was I would make a mentality to try to go out to the mailbox to get the mail, and that usually took about 3 days. It would take me a while to get upstairs to change into some old dirty clothes that weren't as dirty as the clothes that I had been wearing here the last couple of days, put a different set on, get back downstairs, get that accomplished, and then stop and time this right so that I could go outside when it was daylight, so I could at least wave to neighbors, small talk with somebody for a minute before I had to roll back into the house. That's how much self-hatred I had. A couple of months before this, somewhere around 6 months before I was stopped, I had been in Richmond for about 6 months. The last year of my drinking was in Richmond. I had been brought there from Las Vegas, where I'd lived for several years. And I had managed during that time to be in this little apartment that we had and was having problems getting out of this apartment, so I didn't know anybody here. Had no phone numbers, no names, no nothing, but there was this one guy that I was drinking with. He died about a month after I got sober. He drank himself literally to death. And but at this time, we'd struck up conversations about all kinds of stuff, and this guy was in disbelief that I'd had some of the past backgrounds that I had in my life, and he'd bring up different topics at different times during these few months we were drinking together. And finally one day, I'll never forget this as long as I live, God help me, please. He came over one day and he says, there's something I want to talk to you about, Jeff. And I said, okay. And he pulls out of a bag, well, he had a bottle. He set this bottle of vodka on the table. And there went the gag reflex, and I've got to get ready in order to start drinking again. And he pulled out of the bag a book. And he says, have you ever heard of AA? And I went, yeah, I know all about AA. And he's pulling an AA big book out with the cover still on it. And he starts to talk about how, in effect, what it came down to was he'd been in and out of the fellowship for years. It had never gone to more than a meeting or two at a time. And for several years, went 3 or 4 days. He was just perpetually drunk and perpetually going to meetings. And one of the things he did is he went through all of the things that he objected about what he saw. And each one of these things, I said, yeah, you're right. Yeah, he was amazingly right. He just didn't know what to do about the things he was observing. We all know, I'm assuming I'm in a room with people who love AA and are privileged to be here, or there's at least a prevailing sentiment of that, but we also all know some of the nooks and crannies, the things that go on here that are unacceptable. And he would see these things and not come back. And as he's going down this list and describing this stuff to me, he says, he stops for a minute, and finally his tears start running down his eyes. And he said to me, Jeff, every time I bring up any topic, anything I want to talk to you about, it seems like you know so much more about it than I do. He said, it makes me feel, you know, like a piece of you know what. And I said, oh my God, that's not what I think of you at all. That's not what I'm trying to do. He says, even AA, you're telling me you know all about AA? And he looks at me, and at that, like a week before, I found my old big book. Yeah, I had a big book. And it's in its zippered case, and it was under the coffee table. And I said, do me a favor and pull that case out from underneath there. And so he did, and he unzips this thing, and he's looking through it. And he's just, his jaw drops. There's lots of history notes in there. There's tons of notes in there. There's all kinds of highlight things. And he starts crying again. And he says, Jeff, I don't understand. He says, what's a guy like you doing here drinking with a guy like me? See, I'd been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 11 years once before. The drinking condition that I just described to you came to me with full knowledge of my own condition. I had at one time before been a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd sponsored several men and some women. I had been very active in service through the regional level. Was mentored by trustees of the General Service Board. I had good sponsorship. And what I just described to you the last month or two of my drinking was the end of a 3-year relapse. And what I'd become in that time was somebody that was virtually unrecognizable, somebody who had ever even seen AA before. This man had been perpetually going in and out, and he did not even recognize that I even had any idea what AA was, let alone had ever been to a meeting anywhere. And the reason I do not want to forget that is this: I was given a gift that guy wanted and couldn't have for whatever reasons. And because of some twists in my own thinking back before, left unresolved, manifest himself or became perfected. And I thought that my concept of getting well was to somehow graduate from Alcoholics Anonymous. Imagine the perverse pride in that, that I would somehow lose the gratitude for being a member of this fellowship, that I would somehow believe that I had repaid my debt to you folks who had taken me in and saved my life. Because the first time I bottomed out drinking, it was very similar. It wasn't quite to that stage. I would have been what would have been a late type or category 3 or early category 4, as it's described in Two Wives. And what I ended up in was a full-blown category 4. I wasn't a socially dangerous person. That's about the only, I wasn't a physical danger, a violent danger to myself or other human beings, and that's the only part of that type 4 that I didn't fall into. Apart from God, I cannot be sober. When I said I was an alcoholic, sometimes what I will try to do is help folks understand what that means to me, because I've heard a lot of people define alcoholism a lot of different ways. I am a hopeless variety alcoholic, which tells me that there are different types of alcoholics in this world. Some are worse than others. As a hopeless variety alcoholic, I started out like almost every alcoholic, and that is I am unable to successfully metabolize alcohol. If I put a drink in me, because of the way my body processes this food, I process it too slow and it produces a physical craving. That right there explains a lot about my early drinking. It explains why I would tell my young bride or wife when I was 19, 20 years old, that I'm just going to stop. First of all, this was early in my drinking, because I could call her and tell her I was going to stop at the bar, and she was all right with that. So I could do that and tell her I was going to be there and have a couple of drinks, and a couple of drinks would turn into a couple hours. In those days, we didn't have cell phones, so you had to go back to the phone and call them, and update the situation. And it was always, I'm going to be home later. And, ultimately what that turned into is a couple of drinks sometimes turned into a couple of days. And I'd never been given an explanation that helped truly explain why I drank like that. And I drank like that from the very beginning of my drinking. I was always one that I drank too much when I drank, with almost no exception. I have the condition of body that I'm allergic to alcohol. It's poison for me to drink, and it always was. When I put a drink in me, that allergy manifests itself, and it manifests itself in a craving. Now, for a long time, I never understood why, and I've heard this said in the fellowship a lot, I never understood why people would get a couple of drinks in them and say, I feel tipsy, I feel out of control, I think I've had enough, and I'm going to quit. I'm like, what? I couldn't conceive that. I didn't understand why you even hear. Anyway, I could share all kinds of thoughts that would go with that at any given time. But the truth of the matter is, now I'm very clear on why that happens. Alcohol itself is a poison. And what the brain does is it goes through basic survival instincts, and it tries to start protecting itself. So it starts slowing down and then shutting down basic functions. Motor skills, judgment, the ability to speak. It's trying to protect itself, because above a certain amount, it's poison. But because I have this phenomenon of craving, that sends a signal to a different part of the brain that overwrites basic survival instincts. Not only does it override all those warning signs that normal people have, it also at the same time produces a euphoria that no other human being outside of folks like us can comprehend, and that for which most of us have a hard time trying to explain to other people. And it does both at the same time. That's what the manifestation of that allergy does. It produces a craving, and it overwrites everything that's normal about a brain. Not only does it create that euphoric state, some of that stuff stays there in the brain, and I remember it that way, regardless of what else may happen. The very first time I drank, so what happens over time with that form of alcoholism is the phenomenon of craving never gets any better. If anything, I get older, the liver struggles more. There's a lot of wear and tear, so that phenomenon of craving actually gets worse. And my drinking, once I start drinking, starts to accelerate even more so. But I don't know I have this problem, so my brain's trying to simulate how to make this stuff right. So I start getting used to it. The first twist that happens in my brain because of that phenomenon of craving is I start thinking that's what's supposed to happen when you drink. And I didn't know from the very beginning none of that's true. So I've got one problem that's a slam dunk right off the bat. And the second causation or manifestation of that allergy is, over time, I'm going to keep developing more and more mental twists to try to reconcile this. I've been given a case of euphoria, and at the same time, something happened that was very undesirable. And I've got to find a way to reconcile that. And if you had the euphoric effect that happened when you first drank, you would be trying to figure out how to keep that going, too. And I don't know that I'm doomed from the very beginning. And that's why I can stand here and say to each one of you, drinking, knowing what I know now with full knowledge of my own condition, drinking never worked. It did not work and then quit working. Now, I thought so at the time. I can tell you what I thought when I first came into the fellowship. But I, with full knowledge of my own condition, I know now that that was never true. It seemed like it, the sense of ease and comfort that came at once. This fleeting, untruthful thing that was not real and never was real. So how does that develop over time? When I first started drinking, the very first time I drank, I got started a little late in this deal. I was 18 years old. I'll tell you, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm a product of two school teachers, career school teachers, secondary administrator and school teacher. And I'm not sure why that's relevant, but... I didn't start drinking until I was 18 because I didn't have that choice. I grew up in a home that was very, very strict. And me fearing authority constantly, the thought never crossed my mind to challenge it. I didn't learn about that until I got into meetings in AA and started listening to you guys talk about how you were bucking your parents or whatever. I'm like, oh, you mean you can do that? I could have done that. What were they going to do? That thought had never crossed my mind. I was frightened. I was frightened from before I ever started drinking. But the very first time I drank, I went to work at this job that was, you know, kind of a post-high school job in a tourist area in the southern part of the state, and I could be somebody nobody knew. Nobody there was going to know that I had been very shy, that I was an introvert, that I knew people in every crowd in school but didn't really know anybody. Everybody had always been at arm's length in my life. And they invited me to this party, and they didn't know I didn't have any experience partying. And they said, it's a kegger, so bring your kegger cup. Well, I didn't have a kegger cup. So what am I going to do? Well, I went to the store and found the biggest plastic cup they've got. I'm already overcompensating for something that isn't real. That's my sense of who I am as a human being. And I show up at this party, and I'll never forget this, that knocked on the door. You know, you can hear the music going. I'm like, I'm in trouble now. I can't fake this. I opened the door, and I took a quick scan, and, you know, over to my right was this little area that was serving as a dance floor. And there were guys and girls there dancing. I can't fake that. I'm in trouble already. And as I scan the room, over on the left is this little living room area, and there's people sitting around socializing, again, men and women together. And I'm going, I don't know how to fake that either. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw something way back in the corner, into the foyer or into a nook or whatever it's called. I could see the edges of a kitchen. There was the keg sitting in the kitchen floor, and there was three or four people that were just standing around the keg. And I went, I can go fake that. And I went over to that keg, and I started trying to act like I knew how to fill up the cup, and I didn't. It was mostly foam. and I didn't know how to do otherwise, and I didn't want you all to know that I didn't know how to work that keg, you know. And I took the first swig of that booze. Now, I've heard people say that the first time they drank the thing just went, ah. That wasn't true for me. I had drank milk, juice, tea, and the like before, and I took a drink of this stuff, and I thought, this is gross. I almost gagged. I'm like, who drinks this? And I remember taking the next few swigs, not wanting y'all to know that's what was happening. And I don't remember the rest of the night. I learned later on that I had vomited several times. Most of them were controlled in the fact that I was out on the front lawn doing it. So there's your phenomenon of craving kicking in already. I'm drinking beyond my body's ability to even metabolize this stuff, and it's trying to get rid of it. I know that now with how you find folks to find alcoholism for me. I drank my way into a blackout. I drove home in someone else's car. And I will tell you, although I may not have been aware of it at the time, that I had been, like everybody else in this world, was created by a loving creator. And inside my heart is a fundamental idea of what's right and what's wrong. Whether I was taught it or whether it was reinforced or not, deep down inside, it's inside all of us. The idea of vomiting as a part of a good time or other select bowel movements is not my idea of having fun. Having no memory of what went on is not my idea of having fun. Putting the lives of other people in danger by trying to drive a car home is not my idea of what it means to have a good time. And later on, some other twists happened. I didn't wake up until late that afternoon. My idea of not showing up to work, not calling anybody, waking up late in the afternoon, not knowing if it's morning or afternoon, is not my idea of having a good time. And I got woke up by a phone call, and it was one of the people that had been at the party. And here's where the next immoral twist kicked in. He's like, man, you were just the bomb last night. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I saw pictures later. They were Polaroid back in those days. Anybody remembers Polaroids? There were all these successive group shots of all of us partying as this night went on. And in one of them, there's one girl next to me. In the next one, an hour later, it's a different girl. And in the third one, we're not even posing for the picture. It's girl number three, and we're doing things that you don't normally do while someone's taking photographs. Now, yes, I was afraid of girls, and yes, I'm a healthy male, and anyway, I don't know quite how to say that, but that was not my idea of what was right or wrong or a good time either. A couple of those girls, one got mad at the other because I just moved on in the middle of this party. Said, see you, bye to this one, and went over to this one, just walked across the room and began doing things with somebody else. So I apparently had a really good time with girl number three that night, and I don't remember any of it. Now, that's certainly not my idea of having a good time. But here's what happened. Here's the next twist that kicked in. He's bragging about it. And I'm starting to think that I belong. Somebody's actually bragging about what Jeff did in a social situation. So there's the first perversion. I'm going, this is cool. I've just run roughshod on all kinds of core moral beliefs that were instilled in me when I was created, and I'm not conscious of this. I can only tell you this looking at it in hindsight. My drinking never got any better after that. It cannot get any better after that. I cannot safely use alcohol. So what happened over time, the long haul of it is, I'm drinking. Each time I drink, there are perversions happening for which I'm putting irrational twists on, and my mind is becoming more and more twisted, and it's becoming more and more damaged. My body is becoming more and more damaged, and now I've got so many twists and layers in my head, I don't know the true from the false. The other thing that happens is some of that stuff that I did, I could go on and tell you a lot of stories. But I did things that produced guilt and shame inside of me when I drank, and what that was doing was driving me to drink again. That begins the death spiral. That's when the loop between these two, the manifestation, this twofold part of the manifestation becomes a closed death spiral. Now I'm drinking because of what happened when I drank. So I'm going to drink again. Things are going to happen. And I'm going to drink again because of what happened when I drank. And I'm not conscious of any of this. I'm not one of those guys that I've heard people talking about going to the ABC store and then, you know, a little while later going to a different ABC store so they didn't know what they were consuming. By the time I got to Richmond years later, where there were ABC stores, I would go to the ABC store, and that was the only people left that would talk to me. So I'm striking up friendships. The idea I'd walk back in, and they knew who I was and how long I'd been there, was like, hey, you know, I had that all perverted too. I wasn't trying to hide anything. I just became a pathetic, lethal mess. I don't know where I want to go with that. Other than the problem of body is starting to create a problem of mind that doesn't happen all at once. The problem of body is there all at once. It never gets any better. It will get worse, but a person either has it or they don't. The problem of mind as it manifests, as it became fully manifest in me, that had me drinking the way I was in October of 2010, takes a long time to build up. There's a lot of those weird twists. There's a lot of moral betrayal. There's a lot of painful things that happen that we're all very much aware of. A lot of failures in life. A lot of what could have, should have been that didn't happen. What ended up happening for me was because that brain became so remapped and rewired and so completely out there, I lost the ability. I started losing the ability as to whether I was going to take the first drink or not. My mind has now become too sick, sober. So it's not the manifestation that's kicking in, it's this obsession. I can't live with myself. I can't live with what's in my heart. I don't know any of this stuff. I was the wild guy that partied. I did all this stuff I thought on purpose, and I thought I was choosing these things. But what was really going on was I could not lower my standards as fast as my drinking was lowering them. I couldn't catch up to them. I started seeking lower companionship, and then they didn't want me anymore either. And at some point, I thought, man, I can't believe I'm hanging out with these people. But then I start falling lower than that, and I couldn't come up with a delusional way of thinking this was okay fast enough to catch up with it anymore. Mm-hmm. And at some point or another in my drinking, and it happened twice, it happened both times for me, I came to a point in my life where I wanted to quit. And I didn't want to quit for her or for the job. And a couple, those were gone. There was no external pressure. I wanted to quit because I thought, my God, if I don't quit, I'm going to die. I'm like not even going to survive. The day before my sobriety date this time, October 13th, I was, I knew I was in serious trouble. And the thought came across my mind. It came across like a premonition because I'd had some sort of relationship with God before. So I still had this vague sense now and then of like experiencing things that were telling me something. And what came to me was, I don't think I'm going to make it another day. It's too late for me. I had been trying to get back to AA meetings. And I've described to you the difficulty in changing clothes and going to the mailbox. Well, there was a time there in those last few months where I would say, I'm going to try to go to AA here in Richmond in a town that I don't know anything about. I want to get back. I really want to get back. And I would then sit and cry for a day because I couldn't get out of the house to get to one of your meetings. And I'll tell you today, as a result of that, some of that experience, I will not give up my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous for anybody. Nothing, no one, no thing. I want to be here, and whether I feel like it on any given day or not, I'm showing up. I wanted to get out of the house and go to meetings, and my world had become so small that I wasn't able to do it, even when I wanted to. I drank myself into a condition where I lost the power of choice with respect to the first drink by every human measure. By any way any human being would look at it, I think this is theorizing, but I think if there had been some people in AA around, they probably would have went, he got no chance. But that day before, yeah, I had this thing. There's no way I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it. And I was walking my dog, actually. I thought, I'm going to try one more time to walk my dog, to get out of the house and walk this dog. And he's like my son. I mean, he's an angel to me. He's my best friend. I had this beagle that's just, everybody loves him. But it had been several months since I'd been able to really walk him, and I made an attempt to walk him. And we come around this little pond, and there were some geese in the pond, and, of course, he wants to get all excited. And I thought, what am I going to do with my dog? I know I'm dying. I think this is my last day, and I want him to be owned by somebody that's going to take care of him. So I unclipped his collar. Yeah. That's the way it hits me, too. I unclipped his collar, and he started running to the edge of this pond. I sat down on a stump. He started running to the edge of this pond because he's free and clear. He can go mess with the geese now. And he all of a sudden just stopped in his tracks. It was like something out of a cartoon. Just came to a screeching halt halfway down to the pond. And he stops and turns and looks at me. And he cocks his head a couple of ways. And all of a sudden he starts whimpering like he's crying. And he runs back at me and jumps into my arms. And just dead weights right up under my chin. And he just started like crying. And if that's not God speaking to me through the only channel I had left that I could receive, I don't know. But at that moment in time, I'm like, this is bad. I really am dying. I put the collar back on him, took him home. I got in trouble a couple hours later, went across the street with a little more change, did the same thing again, and I got in trouble. I took a swing at somebody, and I shouldn't have done that. And that is very, very outside of my character. I hadn't been in a physical altercation with anybody since I was 12 years old. It's just not my nature. And was put in jail. And when I got to jail, the offense was such where they said, if you can give us an address, we don't want you here. We want to send you somewhere, you know, and you're going to come back for this hearing date. And I couldn't give them an address. I'd been in Richmond for a year and knew nobody. And they said to me, surely you've got a phone number of somebody. Don't you even know someone? Or is there someone we can contact for you? No. And the magistrate said, you don't want to stay here. And I said, I just don't have an answer for your question. So I was put in jail for 57 days. When they didn't want me there. A few hours after I was in jail, sometime that first night, I had what was the second out-of-body experience in my life. I had a near-death experience. I had been, the last 18 months of that relapse was all drinking. And maybe it might be important for somebody to know some of this. I know I'm backtracking here, but the very first time I picked up a drink, the worst thing in the world happened when I picked up a drink after 11 years of sobriety. The worst thing in the world happened, which was like nothing. I drank two drinks. That's all I had with me. And nothing happened. And there read that delusion. Well, maybe I wasn't alcoholic before. Imagine that. Blocked from God, I can't keep this straight. Unblocked from God, what you've given me is this program. It is very clear and it stays that way. And there's just no in between. But I did that a couple of times. The third time I drank, I got drunk. And from that point on, I think for over a year, I was only sober when I didn't have enough change or some money to go get something. But once I got drunk again and that drunk kicked in, I was the same drinker that I had been 11 years before. And I was also on a very serious downward acceleration into the gutter then, and that same acceleration took over too. So 18 months of drinking, here I am in jail. During that 18 months time, the reason I backtracked is I had a number of concussions. I was having seizures. I was having seizures that would have me freeze up and lock up, and then I would just bounce off the floor. And I remember at one point I told my sponsor when we were trying to figure out, he says, well, how many concussions did you have? And I said, something like four. You know, I couldn't put all this together. The truth of the matter is I was having two or three a week. So when they put me in that jail and my drinking was uninterrupted, I went into another seizure. And this time I remember floating up out of my body and looking down on myself and seeing foam coming out of my mouth and eyes rolling up in my head and the guys in the jail cell panicking. And they put me in a health ward that night. If that incident had not happened, if God had not acted that day, I would have been dead within 24 hours. And here I was in a place that didn't make sense, that the rules were I shouldn't have been there anyway, but they put me in a medical ward, and that's how I got through that day. In order to get through the rest of that experience, I was sent to see a psychiatrist who asked me a lot of questions, and then she said to me, you know, you're not safe here. Your type isn't safe here. You're not going to thrive in this environment at all. What we'd like to do, if for no other reason than maybe your physical protection, we'd like to send you out to the other jail they had across county that had a so-called kind of a recovery program. They called it the RISE program. Would you be willing to go? And I said, well, tell me what this program is like. Yeah, I mean, can you believe that? Let me see if this meets my standards. I've not met anybody's standards in a long time, right? And they said it's run, you know, in effect, it's run by the inmates. And I went, oh, no, you know. But what was happening there was my recall of what recovery is and how that works were starting to come back to me. I know that only in hindsight now, too. I was asking questions because there was some stuff there that you folks had given me before, way out in Las Vegas, that meant something. So she sent me out to this program, and I started hearing all this crazy stuff. And I remember one time I was sitting in a class about, I don't know, a month into this, and these guys were waxing on all these strange theories with, you know, have a relapse plan and all this other stuff. And there was just this kind of moment of clarity where something happened. I remembered AA. I remembered what AA's message is. And all I vaguely remember was standing up in the middle of this classroom, just stood up and said, I've had enough. This is not how one recovers from alcoholism. It isn't. And I don't remember what I said after that. But I'm sitting in a room full of an eclectic mix of people and a bunch of hard men. Half of them were crying and the other half were clapping. I don't know what happened at that moment. But I do know this. At that moment I said, you know, I'll do whatever it takes while I'm here. I'm going to go through all your workbooks while I'm here, and I want to. I want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous again. Is there any way I can get a sponsor before I get out of here? I want one before I walk out the front door. And I fell in love with everything that was done here at that moment in time. Now, I don't know that that would have happened if God hadn't, like a loving father does with a child, when sometimes they can take a wayward child and wait till the exact right moment and then say, I've had enough. No, I'm putting you in time out. And I was placed in time out and cleared enough and given enough information to allow me to want to begin pursuing a right relationship with him again. That's what actually happened there, regardless of what I thought of it at the time. So the rest of that legal process went through, and these people were in disbelief. What are you doing here? Why? We don't even want you here. The judge was like, "Why are you? What do you mean he's been in jail?" You know. But I look back on that and say, you know, that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Saved my life. Those people saved my life. I don't know if anybody in here has an experience with doing some of the work here and then going back out again, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the things I struggled with in the fellowship when I was first reintroduced to the fellowship in the Richmond area. I've gone through the amends process before. And one of the things that were really important to me about making amends to people when that time comes is that they know that they're let off the hook. And in this case, it was my parents and specifically my father. I wanted him to know what alcoholism was so that he knew it wasn't his fault. And that's how I'd become clear on that description, that let the person know, oh, no wonder. So he could let himself off the hook for me becoming an alcoholic. It's not enough for me to be let off. I want that other person to begin. God is a healer. And if I'm being his instrument, I'm trying to do things that produce healing in other people. And that began a healing process with us, and he had, at one point, wanted me to take over the modest family trust they had should that time come, and if he had a long-term or a terminal illness, where he wanted to draw the line, and he was giving me all these instructions, and all this got put into documents. And one of the things that I said to him was, I'd learned this from people, men and women in AA. I said, Dad, we're not always going to know where that threshold is should you get some sort of illness like that. So if there comes a point in time where it looks like we might be coming across that line, what I'm going to ask you is if you have any goals. I'm asking you to set little goals. Is there something you want to go visit? Something you want to go do? Is there some time frame that you want to make? And I want you to give those to me before, you know, you're too far out of it to actually form these things, so that we as a family are very clear on that we're following what you want. And I didn't think about that conversation again, because he ended up with terminal cancer. And he was coming down to those last days, kind of. There was a lot more that went into this. But part of that was I had already relapsed. And I'll never forget this. There was a time in the hospital room. This was several months before he died. And he had quite a bit of time left. He was going to have quite a bit of time left. But it was terminal. And he said to me, turned to me and said, "Jeff, I want to live to my birthday. That's what I want to do. I want to make it to my 83rd birthday." And I was standing there drunk in tequila and didn't even know why he'd told me that. I had no idea why he'd made that statement. The Jeff that had made them amends with him was so absent-minded, so selfish, so self-centered, and so sick, I didn't even know what he was referencing. He had never forgot that conversation. And he was certain that was a promise that I'd made to him. And I didn't live up to it. It went in one ear and out the other, and it never came back to me until I was doing my fourth step with my current sponsor. It came back in a memory, and I went, "Oh, my goodness." Now, he passed away, but I can tell you, trying to make amends on top of amends that were already made is not something I want to see anybody in this fellowship ever have to do. It reminds me of why the book authors were very self-select as to who they gave this to and when, and how far down the scale they would get before they would do it, because I think they had some sort of experience with knowing if you do a bunch of this work here and then go back out, it's almost impossible to come back. It's almost impossible. I sat in a fellowship, sober, with people telling me, "Thank God you made it back." And for me, I was convinced that it was too late, even though I was sober in AA. I had to get over to did I do anything to blaspheme God? You know, I pushed it too far. I had my own experience up until that point. I'd seen some people. You know, Vegas is a hard town. You know, morality is not, you know, at a pre. There's not a lot of morality there. Just like anybody might not know, but the point being, it's a hard town. It's an all-or-nothing town. You'd see some rough people come into AA. I mean, cleaning them up took a while. And I just lost my whole train of thought. I just went blank. I don't even know what I was going to say. I just went blank in the middle of this. Wow. I had seen some people with long-term sobriety actually go back out again, and I'd never seen one of them ever make it. And there was a time when I was sober here, and there was a man took me aside at one point, and he said to me, "What's bothering you about being here? Or what is this whole idea that you don't think that this can work? I listened to you talk. I know you know this works. I know that you have had some sort of experience with God and believe in Him specifically. So what is it?" And I said, "Anybody with long-term sobriety that's ever gone back out never made it. They either waffled in and out before they died, or they committed suicide." And he says, he didn't bat an eye, he says, "If they're sober, how long do they make it?" I said, "Not more than about 18 months. At 18 months, that's when they start hanging themselves." And I said, "Now I know why. Because the haunting memories of those amends that were betrayed. It's one thing to live this without having any working knowledge of your own condition, to drink with not partial knowledge but full knowledge of my own condition, having done that work and lived that way, and then to come back in with the kind of pain that I've caused other people was almost insurmountable. And I thought it was too late. I'm like, there's no way I'm ever going to get over this inside." And he said, "I used to work with patients at Yale University." And he said, "I was curious to ask you this because your timelines are perfect. That's what research shows, too. At about almost none of them get a year and a half. And when they do, they start falling off by their own hand. And he said, we're going to get you through this. Because this isn't the first time in your life you've been statistically the exception to what normally happens. Most of us, in a hopeless case like me, most of us die. Whether we've made it to AA or not, most of us die. He says, so you've already got experience that God's loving hand can transcend this too. Are you telling me that God is not as big as this? And so my understanding of his reach and what he can do in the lives of other people had to grow. And I was reminded of, and I will use this example because I think it's important. I have off and on in life spent some time in formal studies of the Bible. And one of the things that was pointed out to me is all the heroes in the faith in the Bible were screw-ups first. Big time. Every single one of them. If you go look in Hebrews and all the heroes of faith and the examples they cite in there, I think it's chapter 12. Every single one of them had some huge moral flaw, some strength. You know, Noah got off the ship and got drunk, and his kids found him naked. Had to cover him up. You're not the exception to the rule. If you'll just keep doing this stuff, your life will change. And then that dovetailed into what my sponsor told me. He says, I've never seen anybody ever, practice spiritual principles in their life as a way of living, taking them to heart, or their life did not become restored, not one. See, God is perfect, which means he's not capable of lying. That's why God's promises are sovereign. I never understood that before. What do you mean sovereign? You know, yeah, it sounds kind of flowery. He says, no, if he's not capable of lying, then he's not going to lie to you either. It's not possible for him to do that. I was like, oh, that made sense to me. He says, so you're also not the exception to the rule. He's clearly called you. He's sobered you up twice. You gave your will and your life over to his care and direction, and he never gave it back. It says, you may not have been conscious of his presence, but he never gave it back. That third step decision you made that first time, he kept his end of the bargain when you didn't. And I thought, wow. Sometimes I don't truly understand the significance of that decision. I've heard people say in AA, we don't make major decisions in our first year. And I object to that. We make huge life-changing decisions right off the bat, all over the place. The people we're going to hang out with. What are we going to try to do with the rest of our life? And the first one, the one that is the most important, that I think sometimes can be diminished here inadvertently, is I need to make a decision whether God exists or not, whether he's real. And then I need to have some sort of grasp of how I accept him. How do I understand him? I've got to peel away the stuff that I object to, but I've got to understand we're talking about God. Plain and simple. One of the things the big book asked me to stay away from is spiritual make-believe. So I don't get to define him. I just get to accept him. And whatever small part of him I get to accept, that's what I get to do. But I can't turn my will and my life over his care, to the care of God as I understand him, if I have no understanding of him. I'm fooling myself about something. And all of that stuff, as a guy who had come in the first time as an atheist or an agnostic or thought I was and didn't want anything to do with any of it, and I had never been harmed by a religion, I was raised in a home where that whole topic was neutral. It was just unspoken pro or con. So I didn't have any negative teachings or reinforcement, nor positive. I didn't know what anybody was talking about when I got to AA. People would say the word God and they were afraid to elaborate, so I didn't really know what the word meant. And it took those folks a while to realize I had no description that went beyond that. So they sat down and worked with me on that, and we figured a few things out. What I would say, if there's anybody in this room that is brand new or struggling with the topic, there was a simple story that a guy told one time, and I want to share part of it here. He says, you know, sometimes people get into a problem of understanding God as our Father. And there can be a ton of reasons, and it varies with each of us, as to why we might object to that concept. And he says, I want you to think of it like this. He says, picture a really good quality dad. A doting, kind, loving father to a child. And if you weren't raised that way, just think about what that might be like, okay? and think of a little girl running up to him, this little girl. And she says, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, can I have a piece of candy?" Most of the time he says no. Because he has her best interests at heart. But every now and then he says yes, because a little bit of candy in the right measure is happy for her, and the little girl goes away happy. But what really makes him happy is that same little girl comes running up to him and says, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, can I have a piece of carrot?" And every single time it gives him joy to give her that piece of carrot. See, what I didn't understand is God has feelings. And that's how he feels about me when I ask him, you know, for the things that he wants me to ask him about. And what that really comes down to is what I'm trying to ask him is, how can I help him? God had to stop being Santa Claus for me. But he also had to be personified. He had to be real. And that story I just disclosed of the joy that God would have in his heart, his father, for that child, is something that demonstrates love. One of his other characteristics is wisdom. And I get wisdom from men and women like you in these rooms, who've walked with him longer, or maybe a little closer to him, or what have you, that can teach me and remind me how he sees me, how he values me, and how I'm supposed to treat the men and women around me. Wisdom. One of the things that I also had to look at, that he's also just. Because he keeps those promises that I was talking about, he can't recant a promise, so that there are consequences if I don't live by the way he would like for me to live, to the best of my ability as I understand it. That fundamental idea of right and wrong that I was given as a little bitty kid, the one that I betrayed over and over and over again, I don't have to do that anymore. As a result of accepting the ideas contained in this book, I do not have to do that anymore. I am nowhere close to perfect. I make mistakes, but today they're mistakes. Today I feel the consequences of them, or I get feedback, or I've hurt somebody, and I don't want to do that anymore. And I may realize it right away, at which time I can talk about it right away, or I may not realize it for a little while and it may catch up to me. But either way, those are consequences, those are mine. It's his justice is kind of like being in a dark room with a flashlight. If I step out of the beam, I'm in the dark. If I step back into the beam, I'm in the light, and there's really not a whole lot of in between. Because if I had to do the work to step into the light and you didn't, and you're over in the corner getting all his blessings, then why am I going to serve him at all? So he has to have some sort of fundamental sense of justice. And the last element that I want to talk about, and all these things go together as a recipe that produces somebody who's a healer. And that is power. It's the one concept that we of AA know the most about. God has power. And we agnostics, they talk about our living creator who enters into our hearts and lives. It's a beam of power out towards the benefit of other people. The only thing that has solved any of my problems here, both real and imagined, has been my efforts to try to be helpful to other people. And the only way I've been able to do that by any measure is by that beam working through me. I'm just an instrument here to be of help to somebody else. And I couldn't be that and have that if I didn't clean house first. So it's kind of like the flashlight beam is blocked. So that's why I can't come in here and don't drink and go to meetings. You put all four of those things together. Love, wisdom, justice, and power. And you combine all that into a recipe, and what we get is healing. We get the healer. I have been given a very special gift because I am in some way or another uniquely qualified to reach the heart of some human being in some AA meeting somewhere that maybe somebody else can't reach. I can earn their confidence in a matter of a few hours. We can talk about what alcoholism is, and I know that person in front of me, if they are a hopeless variety alcoholic who has gone beyond human aid, who has lost the power of choice, whose only hope is to become reunited with their creator, however they conceive that creator. There is nothing better in life, and I mean this, there's nothing better in life to see those lights come on in another human being. But that description and that sort of clarity will unlock first confidence or trust And then we just walk, we just escort them through the rest of it. And I hope I haven't come across as too preachy or otherwise tonight, but I will tell you what has happened as a result of the short order is this. I accepted the ideas contained in the book and then began following the directions. Sometimes, and I know for me, there have been times in my life where I've gotten that backwards. For a hopeless variety alcoholic who's lost the power of choice, only God has the power to solve that problem. And this is an urgent matter. It needs to be addressed now. But I have been in the trap sometimes, not always consciously so, where, you know, the original, the people, the contributors that put all this together, for a hopeless variety alcoholic, God was the answer. That's not a suggestion. What was suggested is the program to become unblocked from them, because there are many ways a person can do that. And I think sometimes, I'll speak for myself, but I think we collectively sometimes have gotten some of that backwards. We come in here and we present God as the option and the program as a must. Because there's two types of half measures I've been in here. They're the kind of half measures where I was putting half-hearted effort or sidestepping certain things, all the stuff we're very familiar with. And then there's the other kind I'm not so sure that we're always familiar with. And that is where I was putting forth 100% effort, totally devoted. I mean, just doing a false teaching. If God is over here and I want to redefine him over here, I can go look over here all I want to. But if there's only one that has all power and I need to find him now, I'm going to fail doing that. That's why I can't go to food and I can't go to sex. I can't go to a lot of other things. That's why I can't cut all kinds of other corners in here. I can't because I don't have any choice. I lost that power of choice. So to say that I've accepted the ideas contained in the book was not some place of virtual. You know, I did so, like Bill Wilson said, because I had to. And I hope that anybody that may be struggling in here with the drink or any other thing know that there's a solution today. And with this, I will finish. My life before was impossible. It was unmanageable by me or anything else. Today, my life is not unmanageable. What happens today, I either have mistakes or challenges that, for which there are solutions that are tried and true in the wisdom in this fellowship. And for that, I'm grateful. Thank you. Thank you.